Hey there, wonderful listeners. Welcome back to the Stacey Chalamet podcast at The Advisor, where we explore the world of health and wellness to empower you to live your best life. And today I'm thrilled to introduce my guest, Sander Vanth Tee, the founder of Moral Eats. And he has a podcast community on our site and he has his own podcast. So I suggest you check it out. Moral Eats is a revolutionary platform that is setting a new standard for ethical eating. With Moral Eats, you can let the meat you eat improve an animal's life. Sander and his team have curated a range of meat boxes that allow you to increase the demand for ethically sourced animal products while enjoying delicious and nutritious, dense meals. At Moral Eats, Sander's mission is to create a brighter, more positive future for farm animals. He believes that the true change starts with each and every one of us, but it grows into a moment where we join forces by choosing the lives of others and the farmlands and the farm animals, increasing demand of ethically sourced products and advocating for human farming practices. Sander is transforming the food industry one bite at a time. So Sander, I'm very excited to have you back on the show. Tell everybody a little about yourself and let's go right into the topic you wanted to talk about because I thought it was delightful when we spoke earlier, the different things you wanted to go over.
Sure. Yeah, I'm a Dutch immigrant and my family always milked cows in Holland and then I immigrated to Canada and I grew up on our family's dairy farm. So that's basically my upbringing. Lots of physical labor, lots of lessons learned on the dairy farm. And I've always loved working with animals. So it was either going to be farming for me or veterinary medicine. And my parents always told me that if there was any doubt at all in my mind, that I should pursue veterinary medicine because farming can be tough. So when you face those hard days, you don't want to have your mind filled with all the what ifs. Had I gone down a different road. So I pursued veterinary medicine first. But once I had my application ready to apply to vet school, like I did my undergrad at the University of Guelph. And from there, you're supposed to apply to vet school. So I had my application ready. And right around that time, that's when I realized that it wasn't for me, that I'd be able to work more with animals as a dairy farmer. So I came home to the family dairy farm in 2010. And I had all sorts of plans and ideas of how I was going to improve the farm and improve the lives of these animals on our farm. But try as I might, there wasn't really a huge impact that I could make. I poured all my effort and all my ideas, but I couldn't beat a poor environment. So I fought through that frustration for 4 or 5 years. And then 2015, we built our new dairy barns. And I was ecstatic because the quality of our cows improved dramatically. They really started to thrive in this new barn, which was centered around cow comfort. And that's has always been a passion of mine to give our cows the best lives that I could. You don't go into farming if you're not passionate about it for one reason or another. And for me, it was really about the animals. But yeah, around that time, my own health started to slip, which really was an inflection point in my life where I started changing a lot of my priorities and questioning a lot of my beliefs. I questioned the healthcare system and my own health choices, but I also questioned the way we farmed. And I was very much interested in finding ways of improving the welfare of our farm animals, give them an even better life, and kind of give back to these animals that brought so much joy to my life. And that led me to things like regenerative agriculture, but it also brought me to question a lot of the long-held beliefs that I had about how we dairy farmed, including why we remove the calf from the mother. And I realized that I always believed that it must be done, it had to be done, but that it wasn't really my belief. It was a belief that I adopted just from growing up on a dairy farm and listening to all the different advisors in the dairy industry, the veterinarians and the nutritionists and educators and stuff like that. And that I've never had any true firsthand experience with leaving them together. All I knew is that it was strongly advised to remove them as quick as possible and that some people have tried to keep them together and failed miserably. That was the extent of my knowledge. So years ago, I decided I would just try a couple of bull calves and leave them in our fresh cow pack. We have a pack area which is lots of deep bedding of straw and sawdust, and we keep our fresh cows there for on average a week before they go out to our main herd. It's like a little secluded area where it's more quiet. We can keep a closer eye on these animals when they're going through a very difficult transition from being of not producing milk to having a calf and then producing milk. So we had this secluded area. So I just put a couple bull calves there, and I don't know what I was expecting. I thought they might like self-destruct or something like that. Like it was, it, you have to understand how deeply ingrained these beliefs are. So to my surprise, these calves, they did really, really well. They stayed healthy. They grew incredibly well because they could drink all the milk they wanted. And it was very hands-off on my part. It didn't take a lot of work, a lot of labor, because the cow fed the calf. And at that moment, I was addicted. Like all my beliefs got shattered. And from that point on, I was dedicated to finding a way to make this possible at scale. Not just on a small little hobby farms or for one or two calves here or there, but like across our whole dairy farm. I was hooked, and I was determined to make it work. And around that time too, I was doing a lot of learning about health and stuff like that, but also just listening to other business folks. And one of the concepts that struck a chord with me was popularized by Elon Musk, and that is to think in first principles. So if I look at what it takes to raise calves, healthy calves, the first principles are what are called the five C's of calf care. And that is they need to have colostrum as soon as possible after birth, because that's where all their antibodies, all their immune system is built through that colostrum. They don't receive any immunity through the placenta. So that colostrum is critical for having healthy calves and for several months of their lives. So the colostrum is important. They need to have enough calories to grow. They need to, mostly in the form of milk for their first 2 months, but later on, as they move to grains or forages, they need to have high quality feed, lots of calories. They need consistency. Consistency is critical for cows and calves. They've been shown like if you change the timing of their feeding, so it's kind of on a random schedule, even if the calories are kept the same, just the fact that it's inconsistent, you have decreased growth. So the consistency is very, very important. And then also the environment, it needs to be clean. The sanitation, you can't have a huge amount of pathogenic bacteria in the environment, because then the calves will get sick. And then it needs to be comfortable. So those are the five C's. And nowhere in there does it say that the calves have to be removed from their mother. So that's what made me believe like it has to be possible. If you look at what it actually takes to re raise a healthy calf, it has to be possible. It's just difficult, and we haven't figured it out yet. So luckily, like over the years, just for the sake of farms handling calves, there has been a trend towards moving the calves indoors, not for the calf's sake again, but for the farmer's sake. There's actually the gold standard for healthy calves is the calf hutches, which is centered around a lot of controversy. A lot of people don't like these calf hutches, but that's the gold standard for healthy calves. There's no system that gives you healthier calves than putting them inside a calf hutch. But people have been trying to get close to it with housing them in a barn in group, housing them in groups, and designing all sorts of special ventilation systems and lighting and automation. And they've gotten close. They usually might have like a wave of a cold during the fall or spring, and then there's going to be some pneumonia that comes along with that. But they've gotten pretty close. Like the housing, the technologies and the knowledge around housing these calves has improved dramatically over the years. So my thought was like, what if we take that knowledge and we apply it to our fresh cow area? So an area where the cows are just after calving, and you ventilate it and you manage it similar to a calf barn. So the cows are fine because they don't have the same requirements that a baby calf does, but then the calf can still thrive and be together with the mother. So that's what I've been working towards for years now, probably 4 or 5 years, just working, taking little steps and trying to make little improvements and pushing the system farther, stressing it to see if it'll fall, break apart. And I've been continuously surprised by how well the system can work in an ideal barn, in an ideal environment, and with proper management.
I think it's so important because, you know, when I had read the book Vegan versus Vegetarian, and I saw what the American food industry was doing to their cows, it was very disturbing because they, you know, people don't realize it, but they are dairy farmers like you who do it the right way, but they are people out there that are, you know, producing milk, but they're putting all these calves and cows in one confined area to the point where they squashed them so closely together that their hoofs were being deformed. And they actually, when one cow would get sick, they would interject all the cows with antibiotics. And then they would even put hormones into the cows, and, you know, to make the cows bigger and produce more milk. And then people noticed that, you know, it was changing the composition of people's bodies, and people were actually, young children were going through menstruation at an early age. People's bodies were changing because of the hormones that these dairy farmers were in America were putting into their cows. And, you know, I think also, you know, that maybe, you know, I don't know for sure, but, you know, maybe some of this lactose intolerance that so many people in America suffer from is the way they treat these animals, and the way, you know, the things that they do to these animals, it's hurting human beings and their bodies. And I think it's so good that, you know, farmers, you know, dairy farmers like you are doing it the right way, because I think it makes such an impact on a person's health. If only everybody could, you know, farm, you know, and produce cow's milk the way you do, I think it would change and improve people's health tremendously. What do you think?
It would, absolutely. And like the dairy industry is constantly improving. Like our own dairy farm has improved dramatically over the years, and we've seen that firsthand to how much of an impact that can make on the health of the animal. And like, and healthy animals produce healthy milk, healthy meat, everything. But like, because like people have done all sorts of horrible things in the name of profits in the past, like some of those original dairy farms that in the 1980s that were in the middle of the city next to a brewery that were fed nothing but the byproducts of that brewery. And those animals were horribly unhealthy and dark and dirty. Like, they're horrible, horrible conditions. But like, a lot, like the dairy industry and agriculture as a whole, animal agriculture, is constantly improving. And the joy of like working with these animals, especially with cattle, is like, the better you treat them, the more profitable you are. So like, yeah, it's a very rewarding business to be in that way. So like, so because of that congruency, because of like the fact that the cow wins and the farmer wins, yeah, commercial agriculture has improved dramatically over the years. So like, what you might see in a lot of these horror films and stuff like that, a lot of that is old footage, and the things aren't done that way anymore. Like, I know even the States, like in Canada, those hormones that were used to increase production, those hormones were never legal in Canada. But I know even in the States, there's a lot of processors that won't even accept milk that are produced in that way anymore. So like, things are constantly improving and getting better in that way. And, but like, well, the way we do it, I'm trying to be on that leading edge, especially from the welfare perspective, and like really be that example for the industry and show that there's interest in these products. There's interest in from the consumer's point of view, but also that it's physically possible to do some of these management practices and still have the calf thrive, because like, the calf needs to do well. Cause if I keep them together and the calf is sick, it's no longer an improvement in welfare. It's just branding that I'm doing for the sake of making the consumer happy. Like, it has to be in the best interest of the animal And that's the reason why they are typically removed and why I am actually not against the typical farmer, dairy farmer, removing the calf, because like the calves, they do well when they're separated. And like it's kind of counterintuitive from our perspective, because we're not cows.
Yeah.
And what we need to remember is that like the way that cows naturally parent or raise their calf is very similar to deer, in that they're hiders. So what they would do is the cow will have a calf, and then they'll clean up, they'll eat the placenta, they'll clean up the calf. There's not much of a scent. And then they'll hide that calf in the bushes somewhere, and then the cow will go out and graze. And then as the calf gets a little bit older, maybe they'll form little calf groups, little calf kindergartens. And then there might be one cow that kind of hangs out with this group of calves while the rest go out and graze. But at the start, they're just relying on hiding the calf and hoping that the predator does not find them.
Right.
That's what deer do as well. So like it's natural for the calf to kind of sit isolated and wait for the mom to come back to be fed, and then for the mom to leave again at the start. It's like that's why the calves seem to do so well in the modern system.
Okay.
But with that being said, like I want people to understand where the industry is coming from. But with that being said, the way I like to measure animal welfare is by seeing how well the animal can express their natural behaviors. And unfortunately, in dairy cows especially, we don't allow these dairy cows to express their natural maternal behaviors. And it's a real beautiful thing to watch. And it's heartwarming. And the cows, they really do enjoy, well, it's not surprising, of course, but like they love taking care of their babies. So it's really, I love watching it, and it's a beautiful thing to see. But like, and one of the reasons why people cite against keeping them together is, especially dairy cows, we have Holsteins, and they're notorious for having horrible maternal instincts.
Mm-hmm.
And it's true. But a beautiful thing happens when you allow them to stay together despite that. And that is, the calf starts to cycle on the mom releases oxytocin. Oxytocin is the bonding hormone. And through that drinking process and through those hormones, they form the maternal bond with the calf. And that cow, even the very first time they have their very first calf, and they're completely oblivious of what they need to do, that animal transforms into a very attentive and very caring mother. So, and like, it's different animals take a lot. Like, there's not consistent amongst all animals, but every single animal I've seen has the capacity to become a great mother and take care of their own calf. So, like, once you allow them to suckle, that is no longer an argument against keeping them together. In my experience, the real reason why they need to be separated typically is for the health of the calf.
Okay.
During the calving period, and like the mom is stressed, they start to expel all sorts of bacteria and stuff like that. So there's a large bacteria load, and also the air quality, the quality of the air is different. The bacteria and stuff like that is all spread through the air, and then the calf is very susceptible to things like pneumonia. So those are some of the things that I've been addressing head on to try to improve, to show how I can do this and prove to myself and then to how we can do this once we scale it up. So the scouring, what I've done is to combat that disease pressure in the environment, to keep that environment clean as per those five C's of calf management, of raising healthy calves, the cleanliness for the environment. I've been managing that by doing, I compost the pack area. So twice a day we go through with a cultivator or a chisel plow, and we pull the compost up and into the air, and we throw it around, and then we introduce air to the compost. So that when you're constantly aerating this pack, it's compost instead of rotting. And you have a very different group of bacteria growing there. They're aerobic bacteria, they're healthy bacteria. A lot of the disease causing, the pathogenic bacteria, are anaerobic. They thrive in an environment without oxygen. So you have, you're growing a lot of these healthier bacteria that don't cause the scours, that also don't cause mastitis. It's a growing trend to raise dairy cows on these compost packs, because if you have them on a regular pack, you have all sorts of mastitis, all sorts of trouble. But if you compost it and you get that, you get the introduce that air and the temperature increases in this compost pack, you can raise, you can have your dairy cows on this compost pack without getting mastitis, which is kind of a proof of concept that composting makes a big difference. So I do that to prevent scours in the calves, to prevent the disease pressure of these scour, these diarrhea causing bacteria in the environment, which has worked really, really well. And then, but like the pneumonia is more difficult to tackle. So one of the things that I do, especially once it starts, like the spring and fall, and all winter when it's really cold, but those spring and fall is when the calves are very sensitive with the fluctuations in temperatures. I put coats on the calves really early on. And at first I was kind of worried that the mom would come and just like lick it and bite it and rip it off. Most part, the mom's done a pretty good job leaving the coats alone. And that coat keeps the calf warmer, but more importantly, it protects the calf from the drafts, the downward falling air, the cold air in the, in this larger barn that also fits the cows. So the coats have made a big difference, but to really do this properly, you have to set up the ventilation system similar to a calf barn. And we do this in our, the heifers, once they're weaned, they go into a larger barn with older heifers, which also leaves these younger heifers vulnerable to getting sick from what, from the disease pressure from the older heifers. So we put in tubes, and then you, we, with a fan, you push air into these tubes with all the little holes in it that spread fresh air through the whole length of the area where the calves are. So it's a positive pressure system. So you're pushing fresh, clean air right where the calves need it. So that's what I would do once I build a barn for all of my cows, and all of my calves to be able to manage all of them in this way, not just this, the test groups that I'm doing right now in our fresh cow area. I would put in these positive pressure air tubes to really have the same success with these calves that you would have in a calf barn. And that basically is like the last straw of why you shouldn't keep them together. So like, I think it's possible, not only on a small scale, but on a large scale, by managing it in this way.
Wow. It's funny because I drove by a farm yesterday, and they, the animals had coats on them while they were roaming in the pastures. It was, and I noticed that, and I was like, oh, wow, they're wearing coats. I'm like.
Yeah, it's pretty cute to see.
It is very cute to see. It was really cute. And, you know, I'm, it's really pleasing to know that, you know, that our industry, in our dairy industry, there has been a lot of positive changes, you know, because I was worried, because from what I read in that one book, it kind of scared me, because in America, our food industry is a little bit more commercialized, where they look more on profit sometimes than they do on actually helping people. But it's good to know that there are people like you who are making positive changes, and that it has become a cycle in our society to help people and make differences. Yes, I'm, you know, it's very good to know, because like things have changed so much in our society. But, you know, I had read that book years ago, and so it worried, you know, I didn't, until I met you, I didn't realize how much of a change that society is actually made to help improve the dairy industry. Because it's, you know, it was always scary, because, you know, there was, for a while, there was a lot of negativeness about dairy in the United States. So it's good to know that, you know, that the dairy industry is actually improving and making changes to improve people's health and to improve the product, so it doesn't affect people in a negative way, and that they're actually taking care of the animals the way they're supposed to take care of the animals, because a healthy animal is going to make a healthy product, which is going to in turn help people with their health as well. And it's very interesting how you talk about how you care for the animals and how you the whole process of the dairy industry and how everything is done, behind, closed doors, because you don't really realize everything, all the energy and all the things that get put into it when, from if you're not familiarized with the food industry and the dairy industry itself. But it seems like you go through a lot of different stages to help protect the animals, and so the animals, can live a healthy life and also produce a healthy product as well.
Absolutely. And there's a lot of challenges. I spent a lot of time talking already just like on the health of the calves. But like even if say like you manage to keep the calves healthy. And there's also welfare concerns with keeping the cows and calves together. And one of them is unwarranted. A lot of people are worried like, oh, the cow is gonna lay on top of the calf and
Yeah.
crush the calves, which like those tragedies do happen on dairy farms and well any farm, but they always happen when the calf is freshly born and not comfortable on its feet, it's not able to get up and move. That always
Okay.
happens in those first few hours of life. Basically, that's when the highest risk, when the calf is not quite mobile yet. They start to walk around like a half an hour to an hour after birth. But once
Okay.
they're strong and they're capable calves, there's basically these calves are strong and they're really coordinated because they're in this environment, the social environment with these cows. So they're very coordinated too. There's a huge difference between the calves that are raised with their mothers versus the ones that are still in these calf hutches that I'm comparing them to. There's a
Yeah.
huge difference in coordination and strength. But because of that, there's really no risk of the cow crushing the baby at that point. It's just in the first few hours of life, which happens regardless if you remove the calf from their mother. So that risk doesn't go away if you remove them. But one of the other welfare concerns is once you allow the cow and calf to form that maternal bond and they have this really strong connection, the weaning process becomes more stressful. So typically what
Okay.
happens is that during the weaning process, you slowly decrease the milk that they get, and then the calf slowly increases the forages and the grain intake to the point where the calf no longer needs the milk, and then they can just eat the typical forages and stuff like that. So
Right.
that's the and you do that gradually, because if you do it too quick, the calf is more stressed, and around that same time they're moved to other barns, more stress. The immunity from the colostrum only lasts about 3 months, so then that's starting to decrease, and then the calf is just overly vulnerable to getting sick. So usually
Yeah.
when you have a highly stressed process where you're weaning them too quickly, too dramatically, there's so much stress that the calf has a way higher chance of getting sick, especially from pneumonia.
Right.
So you have to make that process gradual and as stress-free as possible. The more gradual, the better, so that the calf doesn't feel that stress and doesn't become extra vulnerable to getting sick. So like it's something that we do already with like the calves and the calf hutches, but you have the extra step when they're raised by their mothers, because they also need to wean off of their mothers.
Right.
It's a double weaning process.
Yeah.
And how do you do that? How do you gradually decrease milk production when you're not the one feeding the calf? The mom is.
Right.
And so then he's like, oh, you got to take the calf, separate the calf, but then you're doing that quick weaning from their mother. So it's really challenging. And I haven't found very many people that found a satisfactory solution to that. I found
Right.
one accidentally. So I have there's a creep feeder is what it's called, but there's a little corner pen inside the fresh cow pack where just the calves can get in, and the
Right.
mother's it's too small of an opening. And the calves go in there, they have their own water and stuff like that and their own little feed, and then they can come back out and join the mom. And there's lots of behaviors that change as the calves age. Like they do form these little calf kindergartens, and they like to hang out just themselves, just the baby calves. And they're
Yeah.
quite often they'll hang out in this creep feeder away from the mothers. And then some of the mothers will actually like hang out there and call to them to come out because they can't get to them. But the calves will hang out in this creep feeder sometimes. And I find that the older they get, the more time they spend separate from their mothers.
Okay.
But And then at the weaning, what I did is I closed the gate and the cats couldn't leave this creep feeder anymore. So it became a weaning pen where the cows could still reach over and they can still like look at them, see each other, but they couldn't get right up next to them anymore. There was a gate in between.
Okay.
But this gate had openings. And my intention was I'm going to go feed milk in this creep feeder and the calf will drink the milk and I'll slowly decrease the milk and then they'll still be next to the mom.
Right.
That was my intention, but it didn't work. The cat didn't want to drink milk. They only wanted to drink the milk from their mother. They'd rather go hungry than drink the milk that I gave them.
Wow.
But because the cats became upset because they didn't want to drink the milk and they wanted milk and they wanted their mothers, they became upset. Then the cows responded and stood up next to them. They stood up next to the gate. So then the mom still fed the calf. And not all the mothers would do this, just the ones that are like have a really the really maternal ones would. And they would stand next to them. The calves would line up on the fence and drink from the mothers. And I was doing some research about it. And in the beef industry, sometimes they do this on purpose and they call it fence line weaning. So over time, I was like, the problem was like that when that happens, it's amazing because the mom naturally is becoming disinterested in the calf.
Wow.
Already. And so like at the start, when the calf is first born, the mom initiates a lot of the contacts between the calf and the cow.
Yeah.
And then later on, it's the calf that's initiating a lot of the contacts. It's the calf coming up to the mom. And then the mom naturally becomes more disinterested over time as the months progress. And the calf maintains that relationship as they age. So the cow is already like some of them are ready just to take off and leave the calf alone, and the calf still wants some, and it's the calves that get upset. But then there's other ones; it's not consistent is the problem. And like I was saying, one of the C's to making the calves thrive is consistency.
Right.
So I ended up doing is I ended up putting a second gate next to the gate where the calves were, and I would keep the cow next to the weaning pen on purpose. So I chase a cow in there. I push the cow next to the weaning pen, and then I could personally manage how often the moms feed the calves in the weaning pen.
Oh
So
wow!
they would still have that contact, and then I would make sure even the ones that were had lower maternal instincts would still come up, and I would keep them there with his gate for 5-10 minutes. The calves would drink, then I can open the gate, and the mom would leave, and then. Started off maybe 3 or 4 times a day, I'd put the cows there, and then twice a day, and then once a day, and then I like over time maybe I'd milk out the calf half in the robots, and then I'd bring the cow over, and that's the way I was able to gradually wean the calf off the milk while keeping the cow next to the calf. So that solved one of the major issues that I was having is how do I gradually wean the milk? Because you might just say, oh, just wait them for half a day. And a lot of people do this. But all that happens, the calf refuses to drink from the bottle or from the bucket like I tried. And then they'll slug feed for the half day that they are with the mothers. And they won't drink any less. So you're still not gradually weaning them off of the milk.
Right.
And then the cow is already naturally starting to become less interested in the calf. The calf is not hungry. Slowly weaned off the milk and it's slowly increasing the solid intake, and then the separation happens, like the social separation happens naturally without me even trying. So then that way I was able to have this stress-free weaning process and solve one of the major welfare issues with keeping them together. So yeah, this right now I feel like the main roadblock is get to the point where I can scale this up and prove that it works.
Right. Wow. That's so cool. That really is cool. Now, with so many different milks on our shelves, like you go into food stores, especially in America, and there are so many different types of milks and you got different flavors now, and they, you know, you have so many different brands. What should a consumer look for if they want to have a really healthy milk for, you know, what type of milk is the best milk? Like from your suggestion, like what should people look out for as a consumer?
It's a little controversial in the industry, but I feel like if you're going to the supermarket, the best milk you can find, if you're lucky enough to be able to get it, is raw milk. That is above everything else, I think the best milk product that you can get. It's a very healthy, very unique product that pasteurized milk is a nutritional powerhouse as well, but it doesn't compare to raw milk because a lot of the nutrients become either denatured or the enzymes that help with their absorption become denatured and they're no longer functional. So you don't get the same nutrition as you do in raw milk. That being said, like pasteurized milk is still amazing. It's just that once you pasteurize it, you have less nutrition. And also, all of a sudden, it becomes one of the nine most allergy triggering foods that you can eat. So and that's based off of the FDA. It's puts pasteurized milk as one of the nine most allergenic foods. So like that is not the case with raw milk. I personally have issues with drinking or consuming dairy products, but I have none at all. No allergy response at all. Or no discomfort when I drink raw milk, and I can drink lean stuff without issues. So it is a very different product, especially for people that are sensitive to it for allergic reasons or autoimmunity and stuff like that. So like that, I think is in my opinion, the gold standard. Beyond that, you can do things like grass-fed milk, 100% grass-fed milk, which might improve the fatty acid profiles in the milk, and especially if they're rotationally grazing their dairy cows and doing it in a regenerative way, you can have improved nutrient density, but it won't be as dramatic of a change as going from pasteurized to raw. And people there's things like A2 milk and stuff like that too. But like once you have raw milk, the A1 and A2, the casein molecules, it doesn't cause issues anymore. It doesn't matter if it's A1 or A2 if it's raw. It's like so then like If you, but if you can't get that raw milk, A2 milk can be less allergenic than regular milk. So that can be an improvement if you have that. Either it's been tested to be from 100% A2 cows, or it could be from some of these heritage breeds that only produce two type of proteins. And then, there's lots, every brand will tout the benefits of their particular brands, but and classifications and stuff like that. But I feel like the next best thing is if you can is to source it directly from a farmer, because a lot of these labels get hijacked. Even like grass-fed, 100%, it can be 100% grass-fed, but what if they're fed nothing but grass pellets and they're still in confined housing? They're not out in the environment. They're not rotationally grazed. But legally, they can still call it rotationally grazed. And there's rules that you can follow too. Like they have to be outside for this many hours. Well, you can do that on an exercise lot. And in fact, that's what happens usually in the winter months on a lot of these farms. So like a lot of, like I'm personally not a huge fan of all these certifications and all these labels because unfortunately, it can always be hijacked to mean something that it's not. For example, I came across that if you actually test the foods that are labeled as vegan, of all things, I think it was 29 or 39% of them actually contain trace amounts of dairy and eggs. So like it's just a matter of definition. What is 100% vegan? What is organic? What is 100% grass-fed? Like, and once you have those rules set that you're enforcing, people will find a way to find like all the little gray areas in the rules so they can still be classified as that product and not really raise it or produce it in a way that was meant when they initially started this certification. So the best thing is to build a relationship with a farmer, shake their hands, get to know how they produce their food, and make sure the way that you approve. And that I think is the best way to consume dairy, yes, but just food in general.
Oh, I agree with you. I think there is a lot of exaggeration on a lot of these labelized products that we see in stores. and that you don't have to, you can follow the rules, you know, to, and, but it doesn't mean it exactly, you know, what it, you know, it's claiming. Cause it, you know, you could have like, for instance, like for some of the products, it said in the United States, no added hormones. So that means they have hormones in it. They just didn't add additional hormones. Do you know what I mean? So, you know, that's just an example. Like, and like you said, you know, you can, they can have like, you know, be outside for a certain amount of hours. It doesn't necessarily mean one thing, you know, and you see a lot of that, you know, so it seems like the best way is to look for raw milk, or to look, you know, or if you, or if you're close to a farm, to try to get to know the farmer and try to get, you know, really, and it seems like you should probably try to stay away from the pasteurized milks also, right? That's, you know, another thing you said, try to stay more towards the raw milk, or you said more the more naturalized milk, you know, and stay with the commercialized products that they sell in the stores, correct?
That's right. Yeah, if you're able to get it, the raw stuff is definitely, in my opinion, far superior. And it's a completely separate product. But like, with that being said, like even pasteurized milk is still a nutritional powerhouse. It's still a complete food. It's still a great product. It's just not comparable, in my opinion.
Right. And is there a difference really when they say whole milk, they say, you know, low fat milk, skim milk, you know, is there really a difference between the three? Is one better than the other? Like, or is one really, you know, what's your intake on that? When you see that, you see that all the time in the stores, they give you the three to choose from, you know, what's your thoughts about the you know, whole milk and low fat milk and skim milk?
Yeah, it was meant to, milk was meant to be consumed with the high fat content. Like there's the fat is in that milk for a reason. And if you actually look at human breast milk, it is much higher in fat than dairy milk is. So like that fat is critical. And it's one of the major blunders, in my opinion, with food labeling and food recommendations in the past 70 years, is this trend towards low fat and then lower calories. Like, yes, there's technically less calories if you're drinking 1% or skim milk, but it's also less satiating and your body is craving those fats. And it's not just the saturated fats and the healthy fats in the dairy products or any other product for that matter. There's a lot of nutrition that require fats to be absorbed.
Yeah.
They're actually only found in the fats. There's a lot of fat soluble vitamins that you can only find in the fat. And arguably those are some of the most critical nutrients for our health. That you need those fats. And I know I've tried all sorts of different diets with different fat contents and different contents of like different portions of animal products. Like, doesn't matter who you listen to, basically everybody says you should eat whole foods. But then once you do that, do you eat 100% plant-based, or do you go 100% carnivore? Where do you fall? What's the ideal diet? And ultimately, people need to try for themselves, and I think they should try for themselves to see what their body actually tells them. But I was blown away, and like when you learn to like get in tune with your body and what your body wants. And one of the things that I noticed is that when I was eating a relatively low fat, and with that being said, I have the caveat that I was really putting a lot of emphasis on trying to eat as much plant-based fats at that time. I was adding avocados and seeds and nuts to every single meal I ate, and a lot of it because I need a lot of calories. I have an active lifestyle.
Yeah.
So I was eating lots of these healthy fats, but nothing from animal products at that time. Because at that time, that was what was considered the healthiest diet, and I was struggling with my own health conditions. So I was desperate. Healthy, I was willing to try anything. But in that time, I could be full and stuffed, and I could have these massive meals, and I would still have cravings afterwards. Like I always, and one craving in particular that I could never shake was the craving for chocolate. I consumed 95% dark chocolate because that's the healthiest chocolate, with all the antioxidants and everything else in there they talk about. But I could never get enough of it. And I realized after the fact that chocolate is one of maybe two plant sources of saturated fats. And so like You need those saturated fats. And cholesterol as well is also demonized, but wrongly so. Like your brain is 20% cholesterol, 60% fat. Every hormone is based off of cholesterol and fats. Like you need those building blocks to create those hormones. And
Right.
like it's like every cell membrane of your body is made with fats, saturated fats and cholesterols. So it's
Yeah.
like and every organelle within those cells are also made with those saturated fats and cholesterol. Like you need it. And like my body was definitely craving it. I realized now after the fact, because like now I experimented all the way to 100% meat, and I backed off back towards where I personally felt best, which
Right.
is still a surprising amount of meat and animal products, but all whole food sources. And one of the great things is that like I can have chocolate now in my cupboard and it'll sit there for months and I won't touch it because I don't crave it. So it's like I was always this chocolate fiend. I can never get enough. And now like there's really no cravings, and it's a unique experience. Hopefully everybody can have a chance to experience themselves, but like their body is just happy and satisfied, and like your health, and you have lots of vitality, lots of energy, lots of strength. And for me, I think like maybe one of the reasons why I feel so good is like the nutrient density of the food, yes, but all whole foods are quite nutrient dense as a whole. But also the digestibility, like you actually get the nutrition that that is labeled on that food that you research and say, oh, there's so much of this good stuff in there. You actually get it when you get it from animal sources. So you're it's so digestible, and it's also in the form that your body already needs. You don't have to change it from keratin to vitamin A. Like it's already vitamin A. Like it's and they say, yeah, if you eat enough of it, you still have enough of those vitamins, like the vitamin A. But there is a significant portion of the population that can't even make that conversion. And that's just for one nutrient, let alone all the different nutrients that your body wants and needs that are essential. But like, I want to take a moment just to emphasize some of the non-essential nutrients that you can find in animal products. Like the one that's like most researched is creatine. And it's been shown pretty conclusively that it dramatically increases your energy levels, your strength levels, and your mental clarity, your focus. So like by 10-20%, significant amounts. And most people that, especially athletes, but most people that do take creatine for one reason or another, they supplement with creatine. But if you're eating a significant amount of animal products, like I am, I usually eat at least 2 pounds of meat a day, sometimes more, and then dairy products as well. But like when you eat that much, which sounds insane, believe me, I know. But when you eat that much, you actually are getting the amount of creatine that these people are supplementing with to get these benefits, these energy and these strength benefits. And that's just one of these amino acids that are not essential. But obviously, when you eat more of it, you perform more optimally. That's like, I don't think that's controversial. That's in the science. That it's creatine is one of the most heavily studied substances for a long period of time too. It's like there's no side effects from taking this creatine, but that's just one of these amino acids that you can find exclusively in animal products, especially red meat, that has been shown to have this massive benefit. But there's so many more, like the taurine and carnosine and carnitine. Like there's there that all have immunological benefits, that have anti-inflammatory benefits or energy or longevity benefits. That yes, your body can make them, but you're not going to make the optimal amount unless you're consuming a large amount of it. And then so like yes, like you don't need it to live, but you need it to thrive.
Yes, for sure. 100%. Now, if you had to take everything that we talked about today and emphasize some takeaways, what are some things that you'd really like to get across to our listeners from today's conversation?
I feel like the message that I always like to come back to is to vote with your food dollars. There are differences in products and the way animals are raised. There's always those bad apples in there that paint the industry negatively and rightfully so. But there's also farmers that are like the average farmer is great and they're conscientious and doing things the way it should be done. But there's also other ones that are on this leading edge, like what we're trying to do with More Leads and with improving animal welfare and promoting regenerative agriculture. And like, there's lots of those farmers around too. And like, if you manage to find one of those or one of those are local to you and you support that, then that is something that can grow you. The most powerful way to have a positive impact on agriculture is with through supply and demand, and by finding those farmers and supporting them so that that way of agriculture can grow, and it's not just like a niche product anymore. It can become the norm. Yeah. So that's done through voting with your food dollars or your conscientious food dollars and putting them in places where you feel you would like agriculture to move.
Right. 100%. 100%. Now, where can people find your products and where can people find more information about you?
I'm on social media and on podcasts like yours, so that people can find me there as well. But our favorite way to connect is through email, because I don't have to rely on a social media platform to put my content in front of people. It's like I have their direct contact information, and that email goes into their inbox and they either have to delete it or read it. And I know at least I know they got it. So yes. Like, that's my favorite way to connect. It's the most reliable way for me to connect. So, and people that live in Ontario, when they sign up to our email list, they actually are entered to win a free meat box and have the opportunity of trying our product for free. But that's just in Ontario. Outside of Ontario, then we hope to grow eventually. But like outside of Ontario, social media, we're on Instagram, Facebook, YouTube, and TikTok. TikTok is where people seem to find, we have the biggest following, but like I create a lot of short videos, mm-hmm. and that's I've had the most success with. So on TikTok, it's Sander Vance D, and on YouTube as well. And on Instagram, it's More Leads, and Facebook, it's More Leads Farms.
And can people find your product in the United States, or is it right now, is it just located in Ontario?
At the moment, it's all just in Ontario that people can get products.
Now, are you planning maybe in the future to try to branch out to the United States?
Yes. I am ambitious, and I do hope to grow our brand and not just like the way we farm, but like I want to be an example to farms. Like there'll probably be people that learn from our material or learn from the movement. Regenerative agriculture. That's all. I put all the information out there for free. Like, I'm sure there'll be people that pick up stuff like that. So always talk to your farmer and ask how they raise it. But yes, I do have the ambition to want to grow across Canada and into the States as well, especially with the cow calf milk. That's a very unique product that is very underrepresented, and that we are really very much on the leading edge and the cutting edge of this type of management. So that's something that. Like, yes, we also have regenerative meats and stuff like that we're selling, but that's pretty popular now. Like, you can find basically any state or any province, any city that you live in.
Yes.
You will be able to find local farmers that are producing food in a regenerative way with rotational grazing.
Right.
But what we're doing with the cow-calf contact and producing the cow with calf milk, that is a very unique product.
Yes.
And something that I really desperately want to bring across North America.
That's awesome. You know, and no one, I think that, you know, if everyone hears this and is in the dairy industry, you never know in the future what might happen, but I could definitely see you coming into the United States. This is a product I think millions of people would love, you know, because we are, you know, we have a society now that is gearing towards healthy living and healthy eating and trying to maintain a healthy mindset. So I think this is definitely something that people in the United States would be interested in. And it's always great to know the information that you provide because it helps us make the right choices also.
That's right. Yeah, there's definitely an increase in people consumer interest in how their food is produced, and people want to know and how it's produced. And they're and thankfully there's a number of them that are willing to pay to make sure that that kind of food is produced in a responsible way or in a way that they deem ideal. So yeah, there's definitely improving and increasing, and there's also an increase in the trend towards having like a forward facing company. So it's not just you hiding behind your brand. It's an actual person, the farmer, like myself, talking to people. And like the nice thing about like videos and social media and podcasts and emails, like I can build a relationship at scale. I can meet through the internet. I can meet all sorts of people and I can show them what we're doing on our farm. So like it's scalable to build that those relationships.
Now tell everybody your website address so they know where to go to.
Our website is www.moraleats.com. So MoraleEats.com. That's where you can find, I post all of our podcasts. You'll find Stacy's podcast links there as well. And also just some background information and the reasoning behind what we're trying to do with animal welfare and regenerative agriculture. And also like what we're actually doing on our farm and how we're improving welfare and pushing the envelope for agriculture as a whole.
Yeah.
And a lot of the education stuff there. I also have some blog posts on there. So a lot of information you can find on that website, as well as the links to our social medias.
That's awesome. This has been great. Thank you so much, Sandra, for coming on the show. This has been amazing. I love hearing you, you know, discuss about the dairy industry, and I learned so much from our conversations, and I'm sure all the millions of people out there listening learn a lot also. But thank you so much for coming on the show today and sharing about, you know, all the different things that we really need to take into account, you know, and understand how the animals are raised and how they actually integrate with their mothers, and the importance of having raw milk and having clean milk and knowing what type of milk to buy. So this has been really great. Thank you so much. I really appreciate you coming on.
It's an absolute pleasure. Thanks for the opportunity.
Oh, you're very welcome. You have a great day.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.